Welcome to the App and Admin Podcast, the podcast where people work in the real world of IT. This is Admin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we're back after the Christmas and New Year break. And we're back now, New Year, episode 51.
Now,
Now, 51 is the number for calling Peru. So we've gone off Scandinavia now. we're down to Peru. Its Roman numeral is LI, L1. Oh, binary is a good one. 110011. I like them like that. It's a palindrome.
Palindromic.
It's a palindrome in palindromic binary episode. Yeah, that's a title for the episode, right? It's also the P-51 Mustang, World War II fighter plane. Now, do you remember the movie 51st State?
I never saw it. Is it Samuel L. Jackson?
Well, it's got Samuel L. Jackson, Robert Carlyle, Ricky Tomlinson, Meatloaf. It's actually half based in Liverpool, and so there's a lot of places in there that I know exactly where they did all the filming. In fact, I remember them doing some of the filming down by the Liver buildings a couple of years ago. Well, I think it came out in 2001 or something like that, so it's been out quite a while. So welcome everyone back. So what's everyone been up to since Christmas and that?
Well, I managed to break the website for a little while and Jerry helped me fix it. I did a load of updates. Well, I saw, I think it's using my too much memory up on my server, so I had to upgrade it. I basically got Let's Encrypt working now, so we actually got secure connection now to our, you can get HTTPS and you'll get to it. But I do need to just, I have it on my other website, but I need to just do a redirect so that if you go to HTTP, it redirect, automatically redirect, which is just a config in the Nginx. But I need to just do some testing because I don't want to break the RSS feed, so I haven't done that bit yet, but I will do that. I basically did some updates on the actual system, and it all worked fine, didn't complain about anything. I see that my WordPress is out of date, so I've run about 4 WordPress on my VPS, and I updated 3 of them. They all worked fine, but I then did my 4th one, and then it basically came up with that it failed, and it didn't really tell you what happened, and the page refreshed, so I couldn't see what happened to that error message. So this is just doing the WordPress update by going into WordPress, and then you can say the username, password of the FTP server of the local host, and it will basically download the files and do all the work for you. So I had to quit while fixing it, but it happened at like 5:20. I was in the office at work, and the office shut to 5:30. I was like, ah! So I said, like, I'll quickly reboot the server in case it's that. When the server came back up again, I couldn't ping the server. The server wouldn't ping at all. So I was like really annoyed with myself. So driving home, trying to think of what it was, and got home, had some tea, then went upstairs to have a look at it, and it lost its default gateway. Apparently, DigitalOcean applies its settings to some files, and that then puts into rrc.conf when it boots. But sometimes, if some FreeSSD update does some updates, it might break it, so I had to manually put that in, and that now put a manual static route in for the default gateway, and it all works fine. I do need to have a look at that at some point. So if I ever reboot it, I need to run that command. But again, it still wouldn't work. So I could get onto it, but now it wouldn't. Everything was, all the other websites were working except the Admin Podcast website. It was moaning about. It was a 401 error, wasn't it, Jerry?
Was it? Was it 500? Was it?
Oh, error 500. Yeah. So, So we had a look at the logs, didn't we? And it was moaning about that something about SQL, MySQL or something, wasn't it? We Googled it, and that's what Google said, didn't it? So
yeah, I'm just looking because we did this over Google Hangouts or Google Hangouts. Chat. So but I'm looking at the chat history now. But yeah, basically, yeah, it was a PHP error, and that suggested there was something up with the database. So we decided to restore from the last database backup, which like a good sysadmin, you've got good backups, obviously. So we restored that and restored all the actual files that make up WordPress. It was a case of changing the permissions on the WordPress files to what they should be, because I think when you restored them from backup, they were all the permissions were wrong, and they were wrong in such a way that someone coming to the website didn't have permission to actually look at the website files. So I think that's how we solved it in the end.
Yeah, because I think I probably did that when I tried to restore the files for my backup, and then before I spoke to you, I tried to restore the database, but I didn't know you had to drop the database before you restored it, kind of thing. So,
well, I don't know if you do, but it's the safest way of just get rid of the database and restore from the last database dump.
Yeah. Which means our backups work, which is good.
Yeah, it's always a good way.
Because annoyingly, I did muck up. So remember my 3-2-1 rule about let me just have an off-site backup is that I basically back up all the folders of all my websites into a zip, not a zip file, whatever you have on the, into like a compressed file, and then I then rsync that file back to my home server over SSH. But the point is that when I wanted to restore it, I was just googling it, if you wanted to restore the whole, if you wanted to unzip it or whatever. Well, it's not unzip, is it? I can't think what the untar it or whatever. It wanted to do the whole directory. And I did, instead of doing a capital, I didn't want to unzip the whole tar. I only wanted to basically unzip my Abin podcast. So I tried to do that. I managed to do the wrong, I think I did a capital hyphen C or hyphen, and I think, anyway, well, I got confused and I basically corrupted the tar file. But luckily, because I had another off-site copy, I could restore it from that kind of thing. So because when it gets to my other end, I basically untar it so that if I want to, I actually share that out via Samba, so I can actually go in and edit. So that's what I literally just I went into the folder, pulled the files out I needed, and then FTP'd them back up, or SSH to back up. So so Let encrypting is quite good. I was a bit worried about getting it working. If you haven't heard about Let encrypting before, it's like it's a free cert, isn't it? So you can get SSL yeah, onto your web server, but you only can get the certificate for 90 days.
Yeah.
So you have to run up a scheduled task to renew the certificate.
That's right. I haven't quite, because we're using Nginx on the admin website, aren't we?
Yeah.
And apparently there's an automated way of doing it through Apache, but for Nginx, it doesn't work properly, or it's experimental, as I say. I haven't tried it, but I'm still at the stage of this sort of standard, sort of bog standard way of doing it, which is shut down all your web servers, and then the Let's Encrypt tool runs something on port 80, so when you ask for a certificate, it goes to your domain that you're asking for a certificate for and looks at port 80. And if it gets a reply from the Let's Encrypt app on your server, then it knows that it's talking to the right server. So it's just a way of verifying that the domain that you're asking for a certificate for belongs to you.
Yeah, so I've used a thing called CertBot to get the certificate.
That's the Let's Encrypt tool.
Yeah, so I used that to get, I basically stopped Nginx and I did it. And it basically did a certificate for me. Put the private key and the public key, whatever you have to put into the Nginx config for it to work. Apparently there is a thing now where it does actually work with Nginx. So I ran the test command and it did actually stop Nginx for me and then said, but obviously it said you don't need to renew your certificate. So I haven't put that into the cron job yet. So I put a little calendar for like 10 days before it expires to run it manually. And if it runs manually, okay, I'll put it into the cron job for it to work. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
So control environment.
Yeah. I don't know if it's supposed to actually stop Nginx, but it's supposed to do this thing through Nginx to verify that you're...
Maybe, but if it can just stop it for a couple of seconds and then bring it up and then start again, it doesn't really matter, does it?
Oh, yeah, no.
So, not like we've got a mission critical web server on there, kind of thing. I was annoyed when I broke the web server. I don't like things breaking, if you know what I mean. But at least we know our backups work. My backup strategy works.
Yeah.
So that's good to know.
Yeah. We didn't get
that's my week of, anyway.
We didn't get users screaming at us when the website went down, unfortunately.
No.
So thanks for holding fire, guys.
Yeah. Good. So that's my week. What about you guys?
That's amazing, actually, because you're talking about that. I screwed up a WordPress website as well. So
we've all done it.
Yeah, that I'd met somebody. I've been trying to do it. I mean, I'm not great at making websites or anything like that, but I'd met somebody to sort of go over what his site was going to be like. And we were both sort of working on it together, if you like. He was being quite picky, I suppose. I suppose everyone is in a way, but about how he wanted it to look and everything like that. And he said, can we do this? Can we do that? Can we do this? Can we do the other? I'd been seeing him for about 5 hours or something like that. We were kind of going through it, and I kind of made the classic mistake of looking for add-ons to kind of do what he wanted to do. Now, of course, the big mistake is I didn't know anything about this add-on at all. And I was sort of so kind of like, I don't know if desperate was a word, but let's just get something on here and get it working and make him happy. That I install the add-on, and then soon as I did it, it just went off again. Literally, the screen went off. So when you enter the domain, it just black screen. Then it started getting the... Hang on, I've made a note of it here, I think. No, I didn't make a note of the error message up. I think it was 404 or a 500 error message or something like that. And I thought, oh, great, what have I done now? So it was one of those. I just installed a plugin or an add-on or whatever you call them. And it broke the whole thing. So I was actually, I was probably about 5 minutes away from getting in touch with both of you to say, what the hell do we do now? Because this guy was kind of like wanting his website up and running straight away. It was nearly finished and then I broke it. So everything was a bit messed up. And I suddenly thought, right, I've got a bit of a plan here. And I thought, I wonder if I could get on to it via FTP. And I looked this up a little bit on YouTube and a little bit on Google and that. And I thought, right, so go to FTP. And luckily, I could log in on FTP. So that was great. And then one of the pointers that was given to me on a Google search was to go to FTP, look for the plugins directory. So I found that, and then they just suggested that I renamed the plugin directory, plugin old, something like that. Just give it a different name. So I did that. Then I renamed it. Then as soon as I went back to the site, it came up straight away again. Unfortunately, though, at that point, none of the other plugins that I was using was working. But all I had to do was go back in and then reactivate the different plugins. And then everything came back on again. It was almost, I almost as well got to the point of thinking, you know, it wasn't a big site. I almost just deleted the whole thing and started again. You know, because I had all the text, I had all the images, I knew exactly how I wanted to set it out. And I thought I could actually redo all this from scratch if I really, really had to. But luckily, just renaming that plugins directory for an FTP connection and then reactivating the ones that you wanted, it all worked okay. So that was how I got around that problem. One of the other things I've done since Christmas was I put it behind me. A customer of mine gave me this little laptop. And so for those of who can't see, Toshiba Satellite NB10T. It's only a small thing. I don't know how big this screen is, but it is quite small. They give it me because they didn't need it. It was more bothersome. And he just said, you can have it if you want. The only thing he did is took the hard drive out. So I thought, I know. I put the new hard drive in and put Ubuntu on it. That was a bit of a pain to install, Ubuntu was, because of secure boot and all sorts of trouble with it. But eventually got there in the end. And I also had an issue with, here's one on Linux, on say Ubuntu and anything. Is it such a pain to put a flash plugin into a Linux laptop?
Yeah.
It is, good.
has been in the past. I had to do years and years ago, probably about 12 years ago now. And I've done it since, but I think on Ubuntu, they do actually do a sort of click install.
Well, that's what I was looking for, but I couldn't get it to go at all. I ended up downloading a SO file from the Macromedia website. Yeah. And then what I did is copied that file into the plugins directory of Firefox that came with...
That's what you have to do.
Yeah. And then as soon as I did that, it worked straight away. Yeah.
So this is on Mozilla, right? This is on Mozilla?
Mozilla Firefox, yeah.
I haven't used Chromium or Chrome a lot on Linux, but obviously Flash Player is included in
it. That was another thing I was going to do. But I just actually thought, I want to try and get this working, even if I use it or not, you know.
There's also the choice of the Java plugin. I used to have to get the Java web plugin going on Linux
So
kind of similar.
I suppose it's similar with that. We just copy a file to the plugin directory.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But it's getting the plugin out of the the package that it's installed from
It from something. I downloaded something.
Yeah.
I had to extract it, like a zip file or whatever it was, a ZAR file or something. Found that, then copied it over, then it worked straight away. Was all right. And on the same one, so I messaged both of you over Christmas time, roughly like that. This thing has a touchscreen. And I don't know if there's something wrong with the touchscreen, but it just kept jumping the mouse all over the place. So what I wanted to do, I'd never ever use it anyway, is disable the touchscreen. So I found, just by researching it, I found the command X input on the terminal. So what I did was, you go to terminal on Ubuntu and then I typed an X input, and then it gives me a load of different devices, I suppose they are. Are they like IRQs controlling particular things? And then, so it said ID equals 2, ID equals 4, whatever. I put the list that I got into the show notes. And then one of the IDs was number 9, because it was called a Max Touch Digitizer. So I thought, that sounds pretty good. That's got something to do with the touchscreen. And ID number 9. So then I went back to the terminal and typed X input disable 9. And then it worked. Or rather, it didn't work because the touchscreen didn't work anymore, which was great. That's exactly what I wanted. Brilliant, made up with that. Rebooted it. Then the touchscreen worked again. So obviously just a temporary solution. So who was it that suggested? Was it you, Jerry, just to say to do
a start-up screen? Yeah, that rings a bell, actually, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Because I was thinking, you know, like in Windows, if you didn't want something to work, you could disable it in Device Manager or disable a service, and it would never come back on again. And I was thinking, what is the equivalent in a Linux system? Never really got further than that, really. But so we just run or made a little startup script, which you can do quite easily in Ubuntu, can't you? Yeah. And the startup script was literally X input disable 9. So every time it starts up, it runs that script and disables the touch screen for the entire session, which I'm, made up with. So they're the main things I've been up to since the last time. So, because we've had, we've been off a bit, haven't we, with Christmas and New Year and all that kind of stuff. I've actually got a busy week next week. With some different things coming up, so I may have more things to discuss on the next episode.
But so going back to your WordPress thing,
yeah.
I often come across problems with WordPress, but I'm coming at it from the sysadmin side, and a lot of the things that you find online are from the point of view of a developer. So they're talking about. If you FTP it, or if you do this, and I'm trying to translate this sort of their way of seeing it, which to me is quite rudimentary, into commands that I can type on the command line. So that's a bit of a you have to sort of switch your brain around into thinking.
If that happened to you, right? I suppose you're doing it from a developer's point, right? So if that
I'm never in the position of installing an add-on. Right, okay. That's the thing. Yeah. Or it's either that, or people go, "I've installed this add-on and it's not working." So
yeah,
I probably would do much the same thing as you did, and just sort of disable. I might look in the web server log and see if there's anything in there.
Yeah. Yeah, you probably would look at it a completely different point of view. But, what my first one was, oh, crap, right? That's my first thought. Yeah. The second thought then was, I wonder if I can get at my second train of thought is, can I get at the files in some way? Because if you go to, adminpodcast.com and nothing comes up. Oh, no, the other problem as well is when you go to like wp-admin to log in, that wouldn't come up either, right? So to most people who did web developing, the everything is gone, hasn't it? As a web designer, because a web designer is nothing like what you do, more graphical in nature and that kind of thing. If a web designer types this in and nothing comes up, then they're completely and utterly stuck, aren't they? But I was thinking from the point, right, I've got no login log into WordPress access whatsoever. How else can I get to the files? And then I thought FTP, you know, because you can get at them that way. But after that, I didn't know what to do. But when I looked it up, I heard somebody suggesting rename the plugins directory. Because obviously the plugin is what, you know, broke it in the first place. You know, it's a cause and effect, isn't it? You put in a plugin, it breaks. Right, that plugin did something. So, I don't know. I thought it was a fairly clever and quick way of fixing it as well, really. Rename the directory so it kind of forgot about them, I guess, you know. Then it could log in and then reactivate those other add-ons that I already have. There's only about two or three. Back up and running again. My third option was go back to cPanel, which I could get to. Go back to cPanel, delete the entire WordPress installation and start again. You know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that reminded me of that, actually. I can bring some more details to a future podcast, but the plugin was basically saying you do not have permission to install this plugin. So I looked and they blatantly did have permission to install the plugin. So right. It was just an unhelpful error message. It wasn't like a WordPress standard error message. It was this plugin had like a standard error message for when it couldn't install itself. And so it was, you know, you do not have permission to install this plugin. So I can't remember the exact fix for it, but it wasn't a permissions issue in the sense of, you know, file permissions. I think it was some other issue, but I'll have to bring it to the next to a future podcast and a bit more detail.
Yeah, that's great. So that's all I've been really up to.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I've had a few things. I had a bit of fun between the Christmas and New Year period. So first of all, first thing to go through probably is I had a bit of an issue with backup disk space. In fact, I mentioned this last podcast or a couple of podcasts ago. I do backups for some of my clients, and one of them is taking up, and it's currently taking about 600 gigs of a 2 terabyte volume.
Oh, is this the one who was adding gigabytes every day or something?
Yeah. So I found the issue there. The web server log was 27 gigs in size, I think, and it wasn't rotating. Now, so with server logs, what you tend to get is a server process writes something to a log. And then after a given amount of time, or if the file gets to a certain size, I think there's a little program called logrotate, which basically renames that log file to a different name, and then the process continues writing to. So the log is called server.log. It'll come along every week or every couple of days and rename that file to server.log.1, and then the process will continue writing to server.log. And this wasn't happening for this particular web server log, and it had got to a size of 27 gigs. And because this was just being added to, you know, maybe a few megs every day, our snapshot, which backs up files that have changed, was coming along and it was going, that 27 gig log file has changed. So I'm going to back up the whole lot again. So the answer to that was obviously to make that log rotate. And it looked to me like it was just a bug in Plesk, which is this server software which is used on a lot of servers that I support. So it was just a case of basically turning the unticking something in the GUI and ticking it again to make the log files rotate, the equivalent of turning it off and on again. And so that meant that this 27 gig log file became logfile.1, and then the file didn't change and therefore wasn't backed up, so it saved 27 gig on the next backup. So yeah, that was the answer to that one. Another thing log rotate does is it zips the files as they get older, because you're less likely to look at them, but you may want to refer back to them. So that file obviously at some point aged out, and now that it saves a load of disk space in the original backup or in the original server as well, which is good. The problems weren't finished with that though, because they've got 15 gigs worth of MySQL dumps as well. And so the MySQL database is obviously changing daily as well. So those dump files, they're 15 gigs every day, but they're always changing. So every time a backup runs, there's another 15 gigs. So each sort of backup set is 15 gigs. And I calculated this was about 180 gigs of space, because you've got six backups in 1 day, and then seven backups in 1 week, and then four backups in 1 month. So multiply all that by 15, and it comes out to about 180 gig. So I'm thinking of lowering the number of times it backups every day. It backs up every day. So maybe just doing a daily backup and a weekly backup, say, for the databases to get around that. But it's just a case of working out how to configure that. Meanwhile, my disk space is on my server is, I think it's 97% last time I checked. So I just, at the moment, I'm manually going in and deleting database backups. I should really automate that.
What happens if it gets full when it just overwrites old stuff?
It just won't write anything anymore.
All right.
But it's kind of limited to this one partition, so that if it can't back up, then it just will stop backing up, and it won't have any other effects on the server. But it obviously needs to be sorted out, because my clients are paying me to back up their data for them. So,
well, it's a lot of data, isn't it? What would the other thing be? Another hard drive?
Yeah,
added more drives. Or
a different server. I mean, I've come across this in the past, and I've just got a new server, which is with more disk space. But, you know, again, that's another server to keep track of and so on. So, yeah, something needs sorting out, but it's one of those things, isn't it? It's okay for now. It's not
a long-term answer.
No, it's still working, so I'm kind of pushing it to the back and not dealing with it, but maybe I should. So part of that is to track this, I'm using Graphite for various bits of server, monitoring server metrics. So I wrote a little script to... I wrote this script to tell me the amount of disk usage in text form, and I also wrote something to basically take the numbers and stick them into Graphite, so it produces like a graph of disk usage over time from all the clients who I'm backing up for. So that was a little kind of thing to try and tackle, find out where the problem was and sort of tackle that as well. Also, I had my first sort of first screw up at work. So, in my day job, where it comes down to things not being documented and me not having the knowledge to manually put something back in. So, what happened is there was a deployment of code, and as it turns out, there's a little file which tells the load balancer, which I think we talked about in the past, sits in front of the web server and basically serves requests to the web server, and has might have some protection for the web server than web servers themselves, which is sitting behind it. There's a little file which says this web server is up, basically. It's a good layer 7 OK or layer 7 up file. And the automated deployment basically switches this file to this server is down. And so no requests get sent to it. So I'd done this deployment, hadn't probably done any proper testing. Actually, that's the real error here, is the lack of testing by me. So I didn't test this deployment, and I thought, okay, I've run it on that server, because they do something called leg deployments as well, where you have leg one and leg two. So you do it on one leg, test it and make sure it's okay, and then if it's okay, you do it on leg two. But it was the end of the day, it was getting towards the time when I had to do my 3-hour commute home, so I just did it on both, didn't test it. And so this one part of the site, it was not the whole site by any means, but sort of one part of the site was down, because basically this file hadn't been manually put back to say this web server is up and you can send requests to it. So yeah, I've done things, large scale things like that before at different places, but I've just done it at this place as well. But apparently I was the third person to have done it. I basically had started there and didn't know about it. It wasn't documented. And so I was like, I had that defense of, you know, I'm sort of, I'm not the only one. So it's not a great defense, but they weren't too harsh on me, luckily, but they could have been. So chalk that one up to experience.
Yeah, Exchange is the same thing as well. If you've got Exchange running behind a load balancer, there's a website you can go to on the Exchange server, and it'll tell you if the server's up and running or not, or what if it's in a bad health or whatever. So you can configure your load balancer to say, if the server's bad health, don't send requests to it, kind of thing. So,
yeah, it's called a health check on a load balancer. It's called a health check.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean that's one of those things. Always test. If you don't know how to test, or if you're not sure about something, don't go ahead with it. If you can't ask someone a question that you need to know the answer to, then leave it till the next day, I suppose.
Yeah. So basically, did your deployment didn't update this file then? Basically,
no. Well, it's a manual process on the live environment. It's a manual process. Okay. On all the other environments, it's an automatic process.
Okay.
Because the rationale being that they want to be able to test it on live before they enable it.
That's annoying, though, because your test, because, like, depending what, like, if you have a test or dev test in live or QA, your QA or system should be exactly the same as your live system.
Yeah, that was my take on it. You know, they've got 10 different environments. I think they've got 3 UAT environments, user acceptance testing.
Yeah.
5 actual test environments for just developers testing things out. A pre-production environment, and then finally a live environment. And their pre-production environment is in no way like their live environment.
Yeah.
So, and it should be. So,
yeah,
that's.
I mean, it doesn't have to be as big as a live environment. It just needs to be replicate what you've got in your live environment, in your test, in whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I agree.
So when you make changes, it.
Yeah, but I mean, they were very good about it, and basically, it's not the first time it's happened. And it's purely lack of knowledge being shared, I think. So, and probably not the right, particularly the right way of doing things.
I've been looking at OpenStack.
Sorry?
So, yeah, I've been looking at OpenStack lately. Due to work, we've been looking at, OpenStack, just to kind of get it up and running in the environment. Because I actually got a book which recommended on the Linux Luddites podcast, and it's a really good book. It kind of basically tells you what you need to know for system admin. I can't remember what it's called, and I haven't got the book. I passed it to someone else, but uh-huh. I will put a link in this. I'll put a link in the show notes to it. But
it's not OpenStack.
Yes, that's nothing.
OpenStack administration with Ansible, is it?
I can't remember what it was called. Linux Luddites. I can't remember. But yeah, shame. It's finished now. Had it at Luddites. They've started a new show as well, haven't they?
Late Night Linux, isn't it?
Yes. So
Late Night Linux.
So we still get to speak.
What did you think of it?
Yeah, it was good. Kind of thing. I had it in the back. I didn't really take much. I was kind of listening in the background, kind of thing. So, it was good. Did you listen to the last System Administrator podcast, kind of thing?
Or I haven't listened to it. It's 3 hours long. So, and it's kind of a bit unfocused. I ended up listening to last year's one, which is fine because it was just sort of in my queue. But this one, I keep looking at it, thinking, 3 hours, and is there actually going to be any useful information in there?
with me. Because I've actually been in the office quite a bit lately because of a project I'm working on, and I'm actually on top of my queue, so I'm actually waiting for podcasters to come down, kind of thing, to actually do it. So I was actually thinking today, that what was the one with which has got Stuart Langridge in it, the American one, kind of thing.
Bad Voices.
I'm kind of put that off my list because I was like kind of cut down to what I wanted to listen to every week, kind of thing. And I might put that back in my queue.
Last one was pretty good, actually, I thought. Brian Lunduk isn't on it anymore, which, I mean, for me, I don't mind him, but I just like the three guys that are on it, Jeremy Garcia, John O'Bacon, Stuart Langridge. I find that they're a good mix. And Brian Lunduk it gets on my nerves a bit. Just his input, not necessarily him as a person, but his input to that show. So I was quite happy to listen to it.
So going back to OpenStack, just a bit of an overview. OpenStack is an open source framework to provide an on-premise cloud to provide a platform to provide a fast and easy deployment of instances, i.e. Linux VMs, via web interface or API on common hardware. OpenStack IBA can also be configured to speak to cloud or hybrid cloud providers to provide instances in the cloud. OpenStack is a subset of open source packages called services which make up OpenStack. So you can actually deploy OpenStack on a single server, and I've actually can't remember what the script's called. There's a script you can run, and it takes about an hour to run. So you can set up a VM, and you can basically put Ubuntu on it, and then you can run a script, and it will basically give you what OpenStack is, so you can have a play with it. The main services which are included in OpenStack is a thing called Keystone, which handles the identity between services, provide authentication and access management to the OpenStack. Horizon provides a web interface and an API to manage OpenStack instances. Nova provides a computer, i.e. the hypervisor, to run the instances. This runs KVM on Linux. This is a scheduler and conductor to automate the creation and deletion of instances. So if you were like in Horizon and you said, I want to create a VM, basically uses like a message queue, which is the next thing I'm going to talk about, which basically then schedules and conducts automation, the creation and deletion of instances. So it uses RabbitMQ to send messages between these services using Advanced Message Queue Protocol, which is AMQP. i.e. if a user requests a new instance in Horizon, messages are sent via RabbitMQ to the Nova conductor, which is an instance that's created via the Nova scheduler and then the message is then sent back to Horizon once the instance has been created. Neutron handles the networking stack, provides network application and firewalling and load balancing and floating IPs if needed. Glacier holds images to provide an instance to transfer them to the Nova stack service. So basically, like, if you have an image of a VM you want to deploy, that's where it's stored. CMeter provides chargeback and telemetry of resources to use in OpenStack. Cinder provides block storage to instances. Cinder can represent mountable voltage volumes to instances. Swift is Oka object storage, which developers can use to API to access high availability storage. Is it Ironic, which basically provides metal provision to physical hardware to provide provision of Nova host using IPMI, i.e. ILO, on HP, also can be used for power and shutdown physical hardware depending on the hardware load. So you could have like 10 servers powered up, or they're powered off because you haven't got much workload on there. Then you say, I want to create 50 VMs or instances. Ironic can basically then boot up those VMs. Boot those physical hardware up and then put them into the OpenStack, and then you can deploy instances on them. The interesting thing about this is the HA kind of interface about this. This is what kind of puts in my mind, is that you've got all the instances you can run in OpenStack, but the problem you've got is making it high availability. This is a problem at the moment, is a major sticking point, is it?
In OpenStack, or just generally?
Yeah, in OpenStack, yeah. Basically. Because there's no HA built into it by default. they're apparently kind of come over this problem, but you get all these things about shooting the node in the head and everything. There's a good link in the YouTube, which you can go and have, which basically explains. It's basically about high availability for pets and hypervisors, state of the nation. And it's quite a good little thing that tells you why they aren't doing it at the moment.
Yeah.
They're basically saying that you should be using the cattle versus pets.
Right.
Model.
Yeah. I mean, that's so I was going to say in AWS, which is obviously OpenStack is kind of designed in a similar way to AWS. You know, you've got your different bits that do different things. AWS basically say build in your own high availability.
Then you got the problem again, like you've got your front end servers doing that, but what about your SQL server or MySQL server? Mm. Obviously in AWS you've got that redundancy. They present you with a database server, don't they?
Well, it's not quite that easy actually with AWS. There's the RDS service now.
Yeah.
You've still got to kind of provision an instance there and make sure it's in what's called multi-AZ or availability zone. Yeah. So you've got to make sure that your instance, or you've got a couple of instances in different availability zones.
Yeah.
So there's still a bit of work to do there, but once it's done, it's kind of done. And they will guarantee that it's available.
Yeah. And the same thing as well is like with OpenStack, it's all about having local storage on the boxes. And then, but you can use the things like, what do I say, like
the block Cinder.
So that's basically the back end again. So that means, but then you've got to have a number of servers doing it. So they were saying, well, you can do it by having an enterprise solution, like having like SANs and using Gluster FS.
Yeah.
Or there's quite a nice thing that VMware have actually created an API where you can run the OpenStack module as a VM on their thing, and that then basically you've got the VMware hypervisor, so if you have a node died, it will transfer the workload to somewhere else.
Yeah, is it possible with the Cinder block storage thing? Is it possible to make that high availability?
I think that's what you use. That's what I can't remember now because this is before because I had a look at it, but I think it's like, is it Gluster FS you can use kind of thing? Or
I played a little bit with Gluster again a long time ago. I didn't really understand it and kind of gave up on it a bit because I didn't have enough time to carry on looking at it.
But this is what they were saying. The major problem with this is the high availability thing. That's kind of that's what kind of put me down on that kind of thing. It's like you want to make it high availability.
Yeah.
So the release cycle of OpenStack is OpenStack release happens every 6 months around April and October. The names are in alphabetical order. Each release are supported for a maximum of 18 months. Upgrade paths are supported in one release to the next, i.e. you can upgrade from, like at the moment, you can update from Kilo to Liberty, and from Liberty you can upgrade to Makita, but you can't upgrade directly to Makita from Kilo kind of thing. So yeah, it's really interesting to look at it, and I can understand why people want to do it. Yeah, it's interesting.
I would like to look at it at some point. Yeah, it does sound interesting.
I've got my head around it now, so I know what I need to know when if someone asks me a question about it, if you know what I mean.
It's funny, it sits on the other side of the kind of cloud thing. It's like running a cloud, isn't it? Whereas I seem to be in the sort of running stuff on the cloud, although at work I'm not doing a lot of that at the moment. It's all, the servers are very much pets, not cattle. Even though it's all Ansible, it's all a small number of servers which are not replaceable at all, you know. If one of these servers went down, it would be a problem. So, yeah, definitely not ideal.
That's all I've got to say on OpenStack.
Have
you got anything else to say interesting to share?
I've had nothing different. I'd say I've got a busy week coming up this week, so I'm bound to have a few stories for that. But nothing recently. Actually, there's one other thing about you know the Plex server, and that little computer I made is a file server, but we used it as a Plex server as well. I don't know what the right word is, but the renderability of it. Basically, I don't think the CPU in the little server I've made is very good for, you know, doing a codec and then sending it down to the TV.
Yeah, because it transcodes things from whatever format they're in into something that your TV can understand, or Chromecast or whatever. I'm using Chromecast.
Yeah. Actually, I think I'd as well put a Chromecast in over Christmas as well. Which is which has been really good actually. Works really
Something I've noticed, we got a new telly, I think it's 52 inch or 55 inch, over Christmas, and all the video files that I somehow acquired I've noticed the bad quality now because it's a 4K screen.
Oh, right.
You can really notice how bad the quality is in some of those files. So to the extent that some of them are almost unwatchable. Whereas on our old telly, which was still a flat screen, you know, it really wasn't noticeable. So I'm either going to have to, you know, buy the actual the actual content or look at acquiring some more somehow.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Well, I started to stream some things through it, and eventually looked it all up on the Plex website, you know, the Plex help and that, and it said about what kind of CPU and things like that the server should run.
Yeah.
You know, and you can get your you know, like the scores that you do. What's it called where you get a CPU benchmark score? You know, like a benchmark kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it said you need at least, you know, like 2,000 something or other. And I looked mine up because this thing is a
Core 2 Geo, you said, didn't you? Or that seems to remember.
No, what, sorry?
Core 2 Duo, was it? I seem to remember you saying.
No, that was something else. It's an AMD one.
Oh, right.
But I think it had... it may have had XP on originally. Or Vista, so it's about 10 years old. But one thing it could possibly do to kind of test that theory out is... I could install a Plex server on this i5 that I'm running on this one on,
yeah,
and connect it through that, see what difference it makes.
Yeah.
I never really used that little computer for, you know, as a full on media server or whatever, and to do that. It was only for like file storage and stuff like that. So,
yeah. I've got a little, I think it's Core i5 I've got in this one.
Yeah,
and it's it works that one pretty hard. The fan spools up every time you're watching something on Plex downstairs. You can hear the fan going this right. way. You can't hear it. You can't hear it from downstairs. It's not like that.
yeah, I can hear see it what you mean. In the same room. Yeah, but I was thinking then, so when you play a video, the CPU in the local machine is what's actually what's the right wording? Encoding the codec.
Transcoding, yeah, I think.
Transcoding the codec, right. So
it depends what you're doing on the telly end, but
yeah.
Certainly for Chromecast it's taking the video file in whatever format it may be, and Plex will just play pretty much anything. And then it's turning that into Chromecast compliant, probably MPEG-4, I think, you know, just hand waving.
Yeah.
But then it has to take all that video, which is a shed load of data, and turn it into potentially a completely different format, which is a lot of stuff for a CPU.
I did my stuff in MP4, but then the big difference I noticed, and I was trying to think about this, is if I try and run it from the Plex server upstairs in MP4 format, it stutters like crazy, right? Doesn't work very well. But I also upload these videos to YouTube, right?
Yeah.
And then I play it through YouTube, through the same Chromecast, and it's absolutely perfect.
Well, it's not then in that case, it's not network latency, it's CPU latency,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And the other end of YouTube is Google's data center, so
that's what's
no problems there.
Yeah, that's what's doing all the hard work.
Yeah,
it's a Google data center, yeah. And I'm trying to do the same. I'm trying to replicate a Google data center with my 10-year-old AMD 1 gigahertz.
Yeah. There's your issue, I'd say.
Yeah. But, I mean, I never made it for that purpose, you know. I made it as a file storage, you know, like a NAS drive is what I did it for. But then, you know, setting up the place, it's all just learning, really.
I think I managed to have Plex running okay on the Core i3.
Okay, yeah.
But the Core i5 is seems to handle it fine.
Yeah.
I haven't tried really high-res videos on it, though.
No, I'm an old man at 1080, but, you know, I've never tried... So is your new TV Ultra HD, is it, or anything like that?
Yeah.
4K?
Yeah. But I think...
That kind of thing.
Yeah, but I don't think we've ever played any 4K video on it, because I don't even get hold of it.
Now, there's some of the BT Sport channels do it, and BT Sport, UD... What are they? UHD, or something they call it now.
Yeah.
Ultra HD, they call it.
But even just normal HD on a big screen like that is a noticeable difference.
Yeah.
I think we were getting HD on our old one, but you really couldn't tell from the standard.
So it's 4,000. Is it 4,000 something pixels, isn't it, instead of 1080?
I think it's slightly under 4,000, isn't it? It's like, what is it? I don't think it's. Oh, is it 51? No, it's not 51. I don't know. I'll have to look it up.
it does bring the point up. Is at what point do you know, the number of pixels like not become visible to the human eye, you know.
Depends how big the screen is.
Yeah, well, yeah. Bigger screen, you need more pixels, you know. It's
smaller.
Sorry.
No. I think we're going to a smaller screen because my wife has bought this new cabinet to put this don't know, it's a retro cabinet kind of thing to put the TV in. My current 32-inch TV, it's like 10 years old. It's got like a massive bar around it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
So I've got to get a smaller TV to get in there.
Yeah. We put ours on the wall now. finally got around to it. Well, I wasn't allowed to do it. We got a friend to do it because my missus was convinced I would put it up wonky.
So. Or it would fall off the wall.
Yeah. By the way, Ultra HD 4K is 3840 by 2160.
4K, it lies.
Yeah,
it's not. It should rename it 3.8.
Yeah. And there is an 8K Ultra HD, which is 7,680 by 4,320.
My God! But it's no good if it's a 20-inch screen, is it?
No.
So yeah, that was my other thing. I'm not going to be filming in any more than 1080 for the foreseeable future.
No.
Okay, cool. Okay, we'll wrap up then. So you can follow us on the social media sites to follow us.
I posted something on the Facebook page the other day.
What was that? A picture of something, wasn't it? I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, right? It was. I was at somebody's client's house, and I looked up, and they had these old ring binders that looked really quite old. And I can't remember the magazine now, but it's basically one of these computer magazines. Must have been in the very early 80s. And, you know, you bought the binder and then you put the magazines in every week. If you go onto the Facebook page, you'll see some of the pictures of them. It's things, there's like adverts for, what we were talking about last time. There's adverts for the Spectrum and stuff like that. And the Acorn and all that kind of stuff. And these were the magazines I was at the time. So I thought, oh my God, look at these. So he's still got them. He's got two files full of these magazines. So I just took some pictures and put them up there. So that's one of the things to look at is the Facebook page. There's a Twitter as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
And email us. We haven't had an email, have we, since?
No, get no, emailing, no. Guys. Mail at admin@adminpodcast.co.uk.
That's it. Okay, that's great. So, yeah, we'll see you. I'll see you next time.
Yeah.
Right. Cheers, guys.
See you all soon.
Bye.
Now.
Bye.